From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Mashup, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Millie Walker, developer of Mythcaller, the Nightmare Shaman, to discuss fusing two genres together. So, everyone's ready? Let's start.
I'm excited about this topic because I feel like it kind of comes up every now and again, the idea of like mixing mechanics or genres, but we've never really focused on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm really interested too, because I feel like I just have constant trouble with the idea of genres in general. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just like my literary history of reading tons and tons of sci-fi and fantasy, which blend together like pretty often. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to games, like I have a difficult time sometimes drawing the lines between different things.
Yes.
So.
Well, we could speculate for a long time, but we're not here for that. We brought in a guest, so let's introduce Millie. Welcome to the show.
Mm-hmm. Hey, glad to be here.
You're going to help us with this.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We'll have a nice debate, and it'll be great.
or we're going to be debating, apparently. Okay.
Yeah.
Was that? Did no one get the memo? Was it just me? I sent it out. It's supposed to be debate.
I won't argue with that.
Okay. That's the end of the debate.
Yeah, so Millie, tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, how did you get into game dev? What have you been working on?
So one day, one of my friends sent me Game Maker 8 when it first came out. And I thought, wow, this is way too complicated. And I shut it down and never looked at it again. At least that's what I thought was going to happen. About a month later, I picked it back up again, followed the tutorial, and then went, that was okay, I guess, but this isn't really my thing. And then I shut it down again. But then in the back of my mind, I thought, you know, maybe I should give this one more shot. My friend seems really excited for me to be in this. I'll just make one little thing and then tell him to go screw off. Well, now here I am about how many years later, like 12. And I am still making games, so I guess I have not shut it down since.
Nice. Third time's a charm, that's the saying, of course.
Yeah. Yep.
We all kind of have a little bit of that. Like, I think that we, you know, you inch into it a little bit, and slowly you're just like, oh, you know, you'll pick up more skills, and then you start doing more things, and then eventually, you know, it becomes your full-time job. so I feel you on that. I kind of have a similar experience with my own journey into video games.
Yeah, and I think it's really also very common because game developers, even the people who focus on one field in game development, always have to learn something else. It's always more than you really bargain for.
Right.
And so it's really easy to get into these kind of like funny conversations about how like, yeah, it's so bad. I'm living my dream.
Ugh, you know? Yeah.
But I think that it's interesting to hear like a lot of people come to it from, there's the art and science of game development. Mm-hmm. And people come into it for the science. They're like, I'm really interested in computer science. I'm a great programmer. And then I'm going to start making games. And then they end up becoming a novelist in their like huge narrative fiction work or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there are people who are like, oh, I'm interested in the art of it. And so then it's like, well, I guess I got to learn the science.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's any number of ways in, and none of them are correct or incorrect.
Yeah.
But you're always doing more than you bargain for.
Yes.
And that's something we can all share, even though we have different backgrounds and different, you know, utilities and talents.
Absolutely.
Always. And it doesn't stop either. Oh, now I have to learn a new input system because Unity changed? Amazing. Great.
Yeah.
Totally wanted to do that in the middle of a project.
Oh, Lord. Yeah.
You're bringing up some trauma here.
Yeah. Oh, boy, am I.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, okay, let's see if I can do this. Right? So video games fuse a lot of different.
Oh, she's doing a transition.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nope, I can't.
So okay.
I give up. I want to learn. So we're going to talk about fusion and fusing genres, but one of the ways we're going to get there is by, I think, doing a little bit of a discussion on the game that you're currently making, right? Which is Mythcaller. So tell us a little bit about Mythcaller. I mean, we'll link to the website and the Twitter and everything in the show notes and everything like that. But like, give us your spiel. What makes you excited to pick it up and work on it?
So what makes me excited to work on Mythcaller is it's really nothing that I've seen before. One of the things that really drives me as a developer is to have things exist. where if something already exists, if the idea that I'm making has already been released and circulated in the market for 5 years or something, I tend not to be that interested in making it because, well, I could just go out and play it.
Right, right.
But for Mythcaller and really most of the games that I make, I am excited because I can sort of explore the game in a way that I've never been able to explore any other game, just because no other game can really make the design decisions that I'm making with Mythcaller.
Hmm.
Because there's nothing quite like it. You often hear stories about people from way back in the day creating genres like adventure, platformer, RPG, and whatnot. And you'll hear stories about how they come across different aspects of that genre and how each aspect of the genre is created. Well, I want to do that with basically every game that I make. I never want to reinvent the wheel. And that's why I'm really excited to work on something like Mythcaller.
What genres does Mythcaller blend for our listeners?
Steven, use the right word.
I said blend. Is that the wrong? Fuse.
Thank you.
Fusion.
Fusion. Yes. Yes, what genres are fused in Mythcaller?
The game is a 3D collectathon monster taming game. So the platform or the different genres that it fuses together are like a 3D platformer, collectathon, kind of like Mario 64. You got the monster catching RPG elements, kind of like Pokemon, Shin Megami Tensei, Dragon Quest monsters. And alongside that, it also has a lot of voiced over cutscenes with those cutscenes having their own cinematic genre that harkens back to early 2000s games like Ratchet and Clank, Attack and the Power of Juju, SpongeBob Battle for Bikini Bottom. So, quite a lot of genres here.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's interesting you bring up the narrative genres versus the video game or the mechanic genres, because I think that's something that is kind of, I think that's something that gets mixed up when we're talking about genres in video games specifically. Because like we have like a horror genre, right? And everybody knows what that is. The intention is to scare you, but there are a bunch of different types of horror games. I feel like a lot of times when we talk about video games and genres, we're talking about the mechanics behind the genres. Like we'll call something a shooter because you're a first person shooter because your act is you're in first person and you're shooting at stuff. But then like Portal is considered a first-person shooter because that is what you do, but you don't like actively shoot bullets at enemies or something like that.
Right.
So I'm curious how you would define a genre for video games specifically.
So it does kind of depend, because the way I personally think about genre is more of like a tool. I don't usually start with the idea of, like, I'm going to make a Metroidvania, for example. It's more like, I want the player to feel this. I want you to interact with the game's world in this way. So, fusing these aspects of these different genres should work perfectly towards the feeling I want to convey. So, for me, personally, genres are just sets of tools that I can use, like in Metroidvanias, the whole aspect of picking up an item in order to progress rather than opening a door or whatever, completing a stage, hitting a goal ring. So if I want to use that tool, then I'll put in that genre, or I'll think about the game in terms of that genre. But I also feel like that's kind of limiting at the same time. So, as a whole, I would just say a genre is something that it contains parts of things that came before you, but also they're just parts. They shouldn't be restricting you. You don't have to follow every tenet of every genre in order to be considered that genre, in my mind, at the very least, or else we're all just going to end up pigeonholing each other into creating the same game that's been created from the 90s and before.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with that.
I think it's interesting that the way you describe how you came to sort of pick the genres you're going to use in this game. Because I think the looking at the materials for your game on your website and on the Steam page, it seems that it's pitched as a mix of this and that. And that's sort of, a lot of games are like, it has a little this and that and like 10 things. But I think in your materials, it very much seems like it's that 3D collectathon and monster hunting RPG, as you described it to us. But as you also described your development process, it wasn't that you picked those two things to put together because it would look good on a Steam page. The development process is more organic than that. So it's sort of telling that how you pitch a game or how you describe it once you've made it is different than the steps it takes for you to produce it.
Right.
Would you say that's accurate?
Oh, yeah, completely. You caught the marketing exactly. Mm-hmm. That is basically what I did.
Yeah, that's what I was going to bring up, is because I have also worked on a game that fuses genres together. And the way that we came across this idea was we tried to make this other game, and it didn't work out. And then we were like, and then I think we just started talking about different ways that we could approach this game. And then we ended up, like, I think we ended up approaching it by combining the two genres together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was also part of our marketing strategy, because that was how it was communicated to us initially. So it's interesting that you came to that idea without that initial thought process. And then imagine, I mean, every game's initial iteration comes differently for everyone. But I think that is fascinating that we came across it in two different ways. But, you know, we still market it similarly in that, like, in because that's a method of communication, right? I think that's part of the benefit of genres, is so people can understand what it is that the game is.
Right. Like, yeah. What are you likely to enjoy? There's just a huge, so many games out there, and really anything that has these kinds of categories. It's part of the reason that they have so many categories, is just because there's so many options out there. You need those kinds of categories, you need genres, so that you as a consumer know where to look to be likely to find something that you're going to like. And that, I have a question about that later, but I also didn't quite want to leave this idea of process quite yet, because you mentioned something earlier, Millie, that made me think that this is something that you do for most of the games or for many of the games that you develop, right? We've been talking, I think, with Mythcaller as kind of the example in the back of our mind, but it sounds like this is something you've done more than once. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how that process looks like across some of the multiple games that you maybe have done this kind of fusion on.
Oh, absolutely. And a matter of fact, I know a series that I used to work on that would highlight it perfectly, especially put up against Mythcaller. So Mythcaller is sort of like a spiritual successor to another series that I made before called Xander the Monster Morpher. Now, that series was not a platformer, but it was a monster-catching game.
Okay.
It still had the real-time action aspects of Mythcaller, but you can see it's more of a proto-primitive idea that would eventually become Mythcaller. And the idea originally started because I was making a pretty normal sword and sorcery top-down action RPG. And I thought, you know what? This game has essentially been done 1,000 times before. There's nothing I'm going to do with this game that hasn't already been done by Seiken Densetsu, Zelda, and hell, even some 3D games like Dark Souls. So, instead, I'm going to have you play as the bad guys. They have really unique attacks compared to the main character, who just, you know, has a sword and fireball and whatnot.
Hmm.
So what if I do that? I started playing around with it, and immediately I just completely forgot about the sword and sorcery game. That was out the window the minute I programmed the player as a goblin, being able to use the goblin's really unique attack set, like the spinning thing that he could do all the way across the stage. Was a lot more fun than just the normal thing that a human character would normally do. So then I expanded it. I rewrote the story to be more surrounded, or to surround more of a sort of like playing as the bad guy, but not really type angle. And then it just evolved and evolved more and it evolved more. Added in a multiplayer into one of the games. I added in a system that would allow cross-play between the mobile and the PC. And it just grew and grew and grew until eventually I thought, you know what? I've done everything that I can with Xander. I've reached the limit of what I can possibly do with this idea while still rigidly sticking to the same design. What can I do to bring this into the next level? And I thought, you know what? Why not do what a lot of games did back in the 90s and make the jump to 3D? And as soon as I did that, so many different design principles just jumped out at me. So many genres actually became available to me just from that switch to 3D. So I'd say that switch to 3D was actually one of the biggest light bulb moments in the entire franchise that made me go, you know what? Let's throw in some more genres here because we can go further.
More.
The funny thing is, it wasn't even a moment of like, you know, we're just going to add in every idea into the bucket and hit frappe. Instead, it was all to further the original idea of Xander. It all works together. It was all done mindfully, but it's still just more. So that's kind of how the genres evolved to me. It all started with just action RPG, sword and sorcery, and then through years and years and years, slowly adding in more genres, more conventions into the game that would fit. It eventually became the absolute cluster of the genres that it is now. 3D, collectathon, platformer, RPG, real-time combat, you know, that didn't come, you know, on a lazy Saturday. That came after years and years and years.
Were there any ideas that you remember having come up? Like, oh, I wonder if we mixed in this element, and then you thought about it some more, you tested it out, and it ended up on the cutting room floor?
Yeah, so originally, when switching to 3D, I was going to make it a bit more RPG-like, because I thought, you know, if we're going to 3D, I can't have the combat be quite as fast, because with a 3D camera, you can't see as much around you as you can in a top-down camera. You can't see behind you, for instance. So my way of originally slowing the game down was to make it much more bogged down in the stats and in the whole monster building process. But that didn't quite work for the game. Because you'd have these super fast-paced, high-energy, high-octane moments, and then you would hit this big brick wall where you would need to micromanage your party for a solid hour or so in order to get them ready for the next high-octane part. And I would imagine people who are really into the high-octane parts are not going to want to sit there for an hour at a time in the middle of the story to go, should I put Fireball on my dragon? Or, but then you've got the other side of the coin where people that would really enjoy sitting there for an hour micromanaging every cell in their monster's bodies would probably not like it to go into battle and have to do frame-perfect inputs in combat. So I thought, you know what, I'll still keep in the RPG aspects, but they're going to be pretty simple, very Mario RPG-like, and instead have the gameplay be slowed down by being more of a collectathon, having to slow down and survey your environment, rather than having these big, super high-octane moments, and that ended up working a lot more.
That's an interesting thought, because I... when you combine certain mechanics and genres into a thing, it can alienate fans of a particular type of game. So the game that I work on, Vengeance, I'm just gonna use that as an example because it's the first thing that came to my mind. It's a side scrolling shoot 'em up, but it's also a roguelike game. And so I think people who maybe want to play the game, but aren't, or because they really like roguelikes, aren't necessarily going to be interested in the shoot 'em up aspects of it. We tried to combine the two so that, like, you know, things worked out. But it could still, like, turn people off from the game because like they have to care about an aspect of games that they don't want to have to care about. And I imagine you've probably experienced similar things with audiences, with your audience as well, that kind of experience.
Oh, definitely. Mm. I still get DMs every now and again about Xander, no less. Last one released in 2019. They say, man, why don't you make a turn-based monster game? Monster games should be turn-based. Mm, and
yeah.
At that point, I just got to say, sorry, buddy, there's a bazillion of them out there. You can play those to your heart's content. I can even recommend quite a few to you because I've played a lot. But at the end of the day, this is for someone this game is for someone looking for something different, not for, you know, yet another turn-based monster game. Mm-hmm. That is to say, I'm not, you know, talking crap about those games. They are very good for the most part, but when it comes to alienating people, I'm not too scared by it just because I'm fusing the genres mindfully and in such a way that I'm keeping in mind the overall feeling that I want out of the game, and I'm mm-hmm. keeping in mind the different genres of people that would be coming into the game. But at the end of the day, I can't exactly make the game something that it's not just to appease people that want it to be a very specific thing, especially since there's already a lot of that specific thing out in the world. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make something different for the people that want something different.
Yeah, and that leads into what we were talking about earlier about how you present the game and how you market it. There's going to be people who maybe want the thing you made before, someone who boots up this game is going to know what it is.
Yeah.
And so you should have take some comfort in people not being surprised by those things. But then it comes back to how you put these things together. So if someone's like, oh, I like those two genres, I would like to play a game with those two genres together. That person is still coming in with a lot of expectations, like how they expect it to work. And so the question as you develop is, as you say, you didn't just say, I'm going to take template A and template B and put them together. You describe it as more organic than that, but you still, as you work on it, you still have to be mindful of those expectations, I suspect. So how do you find it to feel, because you're telling people it's a mix of these two things, and so it sort of has to feel like it's this thing and this thing, rather than one thing, because that's not really what you're telling them. So am I making any sense? How do you sort of meet or guide those expectations as people start playing when they interact with some parts of the genre A versus genre B?
Absolutely. There's two different ways that I do it. The first way is to always be mindful of how one genre is affecting the other and trying my best to fuse them together completely and totally. So that if you're super into collectathons, the monster catching aspect of it should feel as much like a collectathon to you as possible, so that you don't feel so alienated about it. I wanted to make sure that catching monsters felt no different than picking up a power-up in Mario. But then, on the other side of the coin, you have the monster people, who are coming in wanting something like Pokemon, something like Shin Megami Tensei. And to those guys, I try to make every collectible in the collectathon make your combat better. So you have equipment rather than just like stars or coins or whatnot. You have things that increase your maximum team size so you can equip more monsters. You have things that are kind of like the Estus flasks in Dark Souls, where they're like reusable healing items. You can find those out in the overworld, so that way neither side is really feeling like they're being neglected, because both sides feed into each other and feel completely natural. The other way that I do it and manage expectations is I always try to start games and start levels with something that immediately gets you in the mood for whatever the game or the level is about, be it a cutscene, be it introducing stage elements really quickly. There's not a lot of downtime in the game, and that does wonders for setting up expectations for players from what I've seen, for testers, because there's no moment where they're going to be sitting there going like, you know, I wonder if this game is going to do this, this, and that with these genres. There's no wondering. I throw it at you right away, at least in a microcosm, to let you know this is what the game is about. This is what you're going to be doing. No, you've probably not seen it quite like this before, but if you stick around, this is essentially what you're going to be getting.
Yeah, that's smart. Introduce them right away. I mean, and get people engaged in it right away, too, with that, even the idea of these of things combining in this certain way.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Good tutorialization as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it totally makes sense. Part of the reason that, you know, part of what makes a good tutorial, I guess.
Yeah.
Is you learn the game by playing the game.
You may not know this, but this show costs money.
It does.
Whoa.
It's not free for us, folks.
It's not.
So I'm going with Guilt Trip this time.
Okay.
Is that a good sales technique, do you think?
I like it.
Okay.
It works on me all the time.
You didn't pull these mics out of the garbage?
They didn't come up from holding upon thou.
Yeah. Yeah, we got equipment costs, we got hosting costs, and we have rent now because we have a studio that we're recording. But you know what? You don't need to know about any of that. All you need to know that if you want to throw us a couple of coin, you can do that on Patreon. Mm-hmm. And not only do you feel good because you'll absolve yourself of the guilt that I've thrust upon you.
Right.
But also, you'll get some cool stuff because we have some exclusive content on the Patreon, like...
Ellen's dog pictures. Those are always fun.
Oh, yeah.
We have a bunch of episodes of Boston that we edit, or that we were making it, that are up there.
Live game design sessions.
Live game design sessions, exactly. Also, additional content. Ellen made us do a thing. That was weird, and it was fun.
What did
explain it no further.
Yes.
Okay. I forgot, I guess.
We have bonus segments from our 200th episode, and the 300th is coming up, you guys.
It is.
So we're very likely going to have extra content on the Patreon for that as well. There's plenty on there to keep you busy, and more always.
Yes.
So check it out. Support the show. Patreon.com/NiceGamesClub.
Toss a coin to your podcaster.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
One of the questions I wanted to ask, and I think we've asked this kind of by like, oh no, now I'm talking about paths again. And the last time I tried it, it was a whole disaster, which we did not get on mic, thank goodness. So I'm not going to try that again.
Okay.
I think we've already answered it. We just didn't ask the question directly. And that is, how do you know you've gone too far and mixed too many things in? But maybe the flavor of the question I need to ask now that we've kind of talked about this a little bit is, what are some feelings that you get when you are noticing the design getting like misaligned, right? You've talked about the need to, when you're blending in elements from different genres, making sure that they are part of a cohesive whole. And I'm curious, like when they start losing cohesion, what does that feel like? What warning bells go off in your brain that something's wrong and you need to take a look at it? And if you have an example, that would be great too.
So the warning bells typically go off when it seems like the game is too disjointed, when the genres aren't mixing as much as they feel like I'm just throwing a bunch of toys in the toy box and hoping that they all go together. The actual tangible feeling usually feels like when you'll go through a game and you'll start picking up things that allow you to adjust your character, things like equipment, news bells or whatnot, But then once you're done customizing your character, all of a sudden you come across a large temple full of puzzles that have nothing to do with all the stuff that you just picked up.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not going to mention any names, but I have played a game like that recently, and the entire time in the back of my head, I was just thinking, like, this feels like two games.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And once you get to that point, and, you know, I'm not just talking crap about this other guy. This has happened to me, too. I've already mentioned the thing with the RPG elements. So this happens to everyone, and you get to this point where you go, hold on, this doesn't feel like a game with two different genres anymore. This feels like two different genres that I really like that I'm duct taping together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's usually the moment where you got to step back and go, why isn't this working? Could I do something like adding in more combat to that puzzle area to make it feel like the player has more of a reason to pick up all that equipment before the dungeon? Should the dungeon even have all those puzzles? Should all this equipment be before the dungeon if the whole point is to be like a puzzly dungeon crawler? I don't know. It depends on a case-to-case basis, and that's the moment where you have to sit down as a developer and go, what isn't working here? What do I want the feeling of this level to be? And what can I do to make the different parts of this game feel more cohesive rather than feeling like I'm going to need to go to Home Depot to pick up more tape?
That's a fun way of describing it.
Puzzle in and of itself sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really, yeah, I think that's really helpful. Just trying to think about, like, I feel like creation is so intuitive. I mean, there's a huge amount of analysis to it, right? Like, mm-hmm. we were just talking about, like, when you were describing getting those feelings of, like, oh, this doesn't feel like it's hanging together. And then you've got to analyze why, right? Like, there's a huge amount of analysis that has to come in when you're making a thing like this. But that feeling starts with just, like, this intuitive pull, like, maybe this will work. Or this isn't working. And that's interesting to hear you talk through what that feels like.
Yeah, well, and you said that you're very intentional with the things that you're adding to the game, which I applaud. Well done. Love that on Nice Games Club. And so, like, I think it's probably easier to figure out what isn't working when you're very intentional about what is going into the game and what is not, and you can it's a lot easier to tell when something is not working as a result of that, because it's more of a slow, methodical build and grow and shape the game. I'm like trying to describe it as though I'm shaping a bonsai tree, but
he's using hands.
I am using the hands.
Steven, what happened to your bonsai tree? Never mind. Moving on.
Why do you got to bring that up?
Hey, you brought up bonsai trees.
So yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. To approach the game in that way. And to be more slow and methodical about how you're combining things together, because it can very quickly go off the rails, as you were describing.
And, you know, sometimes it's not anywhere near obvious what it is. Sometimes mm-hmm. it can be something completely unrelated that doesn't feel right, that can end up making other parts of the game feel right.
Oh, that's a good point. Can you name an example if you've got one? I'm curious.
Sometimes, and this is one of the craziest examples, sometimes a level design can feel completely off just because of the colors of the walls.
Mm.
Sometimes you can think, like, oh, this dungeon is too claustrophobic, the level designs need to be a lot larger, I need to make everything 20% bigger. But in reality, you just made the walls really dark, and it's kind of like interior decoration, you just shrunk the room.
Yeah.
But if you make it a bit lighter, oh, the level design is actually very open. It just feels claustrophobic, mm-hmm. which can make mm-hmm. you accidentally do a lot of things that actually are not that good for the game. Like, if you were to actually make that room 20% bigger, not only would that probably take a while, but, so, you know, your publisher is going to be mad at you. But then afterward, you're going to be walking around the level going, man, it takes a really long time to get anywhere. Yeah, don't it? And it just turns out to be, you know, an art asset. So sometimes it's not always obvious what's going to make a game better or what's causing you to have that feeling. Sometimes it's better to let somebody else play it, but other times it's not that good, actually, because they might latch on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that won't be the actual problem because, you know, they might not be game designers. They might not actually really know what they're talking about. So if the room just seems too small because of the dark walls, they might attribute it to something completely different, like, oh, your character moves too slow. And if you go along with their advice, you could very well end up with a very hodgepodge game just because they had nothing else to work with in that moment. So it is a very rough process sometimes.
Yeah.
Very complicated process, but, you know, it's all part of the job.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, actually, because you brought up something that made me think of, like, conventions in different genres. Like, the only example I can think of right now is a red barrel. In the shooter, you shoot at that and it explodes, right? But, like, maybe in another genre, you could pick up the red barrel and it would give you health. And those are conflicting, obviously, right? And so I think you have to be a little bit more particular about how you're approaching communicating how things work in the game, because you might end up confusing players, making them think a certain thing when they're actually supposed to be thinking of another thing. And I imagine that is even, you know, you have to do that anyways with any game, really.
Right.
But I imagine that is even more difficult with this, when you're fusing a bunch of things together.
Yeah, you have to sort of step out of the conventions a little bit because you're mixing it together. So mm-hmm. not all the same rules are going to apply.
Right.
But the player doesn't know that.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So like you were describing, like it might just be an art asset issue. That's something that I've always preached on this show about holistic design.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they say, oh, if there's a problem, double a number or half it. It's like, that's great advice a lot of times,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes that might not be your problem at all.
Right.
Yeah.
And you'll never figure it out if you just stick to that one kind of solution. Like,
mm-hmm.
why does this movement feel slow? Well, I'll change all the things about its speed, but in fact, that's not the problem.
Right.
And you'll never know that unless you, from jump, think about all the possible things that impact that feeling.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Which is everything in the game.
Yeah. So it's, you know, get to it, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, that does make me wonder, like, I hadn't thought about this, but because of the fact that genres are conventions, right? And players might play, they will probably have more experience in one genre than another, because how are you supposed to, like, I don't know, like, who has equal experience? Yeah. Or anyway.
And more experience than you as the designer, perhaps.
Mm. Yeah, potentially.
Right.
So how do you find playtesters that will give you the input that you want? I mean, like, of course, playtesting, you can't just take what people say at face value. You have to do some analysis. You have to ask them questions and dig a little bit deeper into what they're saying.
Right.
If they say, make the room twice as bigger, like, you, well, why do you feel that way?
Yeah.
But how, you know, how do you go about finding people to playtest your game? And how do you run those sessions knowing that you're going to be remixing some things that they might have become really habituated to?
So it's a very complicated process, especially as an indie dev. For a AAA company, I imagine they have legions and legions of people that they can call upon to do their testing. But as an indie dev, I've found sort of sections of people help with different things. I have one friend who is the same guy that sent me Game Maker 8 all those years ago, so... Very important guy. But when it comes to video games, he is a very, how to say this politely, because he might be tuning in. He's a very non-genre savvy guy, very down-to-earth, street-smart guy, but does not really pick up on things in games that much. And I know that about him, so I kind of use him to test for things that, like, a normal person would be thinking when they're going through a level. And whatever he says to me while he's playing a level, I can trust that's basically how a regular average Joe who doesn't play a lot of video games is going to be thinking about the tutorials. Are they clear enough? about the genre conventions. Is it really weird to him? Does it make sense to him? And sometimes it's really funny. You have to take your different testers' backgrounds into consideration, because something that might be confusing to him might be very normal to somebody that I get from my Discord.
Yeah.
You know, someone who's a fan of the game and really loves the genres that they're in, something that they might find very weird, like, oh my god, it's a collectathon and a monster catcher? How? What? Was completely natural to my friend, my real-life friend, because he didn't see things in terms of genre. He just saw a video game.
Yeah.
Sure, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, even though I've gotten the criticism of the game from some, like, super gamer people that, like, man, this game is so weird. Like, I've never seen anything like this. It takes a lot of getting used to. All of a sudden, my down-to-earth buddy, barely ever plays games, picks up the game and is like, wow, this is what Pokemon should be.
Did they really say that?
It's back really. In the box quote right there.
Yeah, it is.
Sounds amazing.
So, you know, that made me feel good.
Yeah, for sure. That's cool.
So, yeah, it really just comes down to get as many playtesters as you can, of course, but keep in mind where they're coming from,
right,
and manage your expectations of what they're going to say based on that.
Yeah, I'm kind of reading or listening between the lines of what you're saying here, and what I'm hearing is, if you are, you know, as much as you are able to, find people to playtest your game who will help you validate some of the most challenging aspects of the design. Like, challenging in terms of what will be challenging for players, and mixing conventions from different, you know, well-established genres is something that can be challenging for players. So you've taken the steps and brought in people from your social circles and from beyond to help test that out and to proof it.
Yeah.
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 We figured out playtesting.
Well, did we, though? Still going to get bad playtesters. That's just the nature of the business. But I think that makes a lot of sense. But yeah, you want to get a wide variety of people, because there's going to be a ton of different people coming in and approach the game. And it'll give you more ideas, and you can use, you know, you basically get more data. More data means you can iterate off of it more. I guess another question I have for you is, like, what is the term we're using now? We're still using fusion? Is that still the word?
It's the same episode, so yes.
Okay.
Thanks for checking in, though.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime. Have you found some disadvantages to fusing genres together that you wouldn't find if you were just making, like, a traditional RPG or something like that?
Yeah, I imagine you can correct me, but I think you're thinking from a mechanical perspective.
Yes, yes.
Less than, like, a audience perception perspective.
Yeah,
I think
you've
covered that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So there are some disadvantages to it. Of course, you don't have as much to look up to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're just making a straight-up collectathon platformer, you have the best in the business there that you can look to for basically every little aspect of the game that they've done right. Like Mario 64, you have his excellent movement, not quite his excellent camera, but you can take that camera and throw it out the window and take it from another collectathon platformer with a much better one, like Hat in Time, and end up with a game that essentially is guided by the people that came before you. But when you fuse it together, or when you fuse genres together, you come across the problem of, like, you'll encounter issues that no one has solved because no one has tried to solve them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot less guidance, and you need to have a much firmer grasp on game design,
mm-hmm,
and on, you know, people in general in order to effectively move past that issue. And to that end, I would probably say the same advice that no one likes to hear from teachers when they're growing up, and that is, you got to learn your fundamentals first before you start breaking all these rules, just because you need such a solid understanding of the fundamentals to really do this well, because I'm going to be real, it is very difficult sometimes. That is a very big downside to it. And you're not going to have as much help as if you just made a normal RPG or collectathon or what have you. So you have to be prepared to sometimes have questions that you need to come up with the answer to.
Yeah.
The first answer to.
Right. The way you're describing this, and correct me if I'm wrong, it reminds me of, like, when you said foundation, I thought of game design pillars. And especially, like, if you effectively say, this is what my game is, you know, you said, these are the three things that my game is. Any ideas you come up with that are unique, because this game is unique in a lot of different ways, you can always go back to those design pillars and say, does this match the design pillars that I had already set initially? And I imagine that would help you in this process of discovery.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, when I was working on Fingence, I found that one of the things that I had a difficult time with when I was, like, coming up with solutions for unique problems, is that, like, we would oftentimes go to conventions from specific older games. But I found that this did not really mesh well with how the rest of the game worked in a lot of times, or it would make the game feel more like a specific game and less like, you know, the game we were trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine you've also had those kinds of difficulties too. It's hard to, like, it's really easy to just, like, you know, especially if you come into games from playing games, it's really easy to just go back to other games to look for solutions for things.
Yeah.
But I think that oftentimes the best solutions come from outside of video games. Those feel like they are the more, they feel more natural and intuitive for players a lot of the time. So I guess this is not a full question. It's a bunch of statements. so I'm curious, how you've come up with these kinds of solutions. Like, where do you come up with them on the fly? Do you go to different sources? Do you go to older games and, like, twist that to make it fit better with your game? Or do you go to other things to find your solutions?
Yeah, like, what's your research process? When you hit a bump, what do you do next?
So when I hit a bump, I'll take inspiration from a number of different sources. Yeah, sometimes it is older games. Though, usually, the funny thing is, the older game inspiration is usually a very deliberate choice in something superficial, normally, like how a door opens or whatever. I'll do a callback to some 90s game or whatever that, you know, if you were around then and you get it and it's cool, but, like, it's not a very big part of the game.
Sure.
I usually don't use older games for, like, very crucial problem solving, just because, true to life, it will make the game feel like that older game, and that's not usually the best thing for this game, because if I do something that really worked for Mario 64, it might not work for this game, because this game is very different from Mario 64. The movement is more limited to allow for more buttons to be allocated for combat. So something like a wall jump might have worked for Mario ascending to higher heights, but it's not really going to work for this game in particular, because it won't mesh with the combat, for example. So what I normally think of is real life.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that Nintendo actually does quite a lot, where I don't really think of the game and of the problems in the game in the sense of it being a game. I think of it more in the sense of there's a problem with the way this part feels in some way or another. It could be technical, could be you with the controls or whatnot, could be art assets. What in life have I seen, have I experienced that could get me past this part? If there's a very long stretch of land that it feels like there's not much in it, should I cut it or should I do something like add in a vehicle that makes you move faster? Is something that I would like to see in real life if I looked at a long stretch of land that I did not want to walk across. Is there a character that I can put there that I would want to see in real life that would help me out in that instance? Things like that, taking inspiration from the things I've actually seen, the people that I've actually met, it goes a long, long way in not only making the game feel unique, because, of course, no one has had my exact life, mm-hmm. I hope, but also just the aspect of being able to convey problems or the solutions to problems in a much more natural way that anyone could understand, because everyone understands the things that happen in real life, but not quite everyone is going to understand things like stats in an RPG being adjusted or different game mechanics being added in that aren't quite analogous to real life. So I always try to keep things true to life as much as possible, even in the most cartoony world, just so anyone could understand the solutions.
Yeah. That's a great on-ramp towards the things about games that are unreal, mm-hmm. right? And so it's not just useful for people who are very familiar with game conventions, because then they have something that they can relate to help them not paper over, but at least guide them through the parts that sizzle together,
yeah.
But also people who are not very familiar with games. It's an on-ramp to that. So that's a very good, I think, piece of advice, is like just a general purpose for problem solving. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's the solution that, I mean, a lot of media use too. Like, that's how movies work, right? Is they ground you in the in this form of reality that you're in, and then, like, they introduce the rules to you so that you can accept them, and then they can tell us narrative based off of that rule set that they've established.
Mm-hmm.
That's smart. Clever.
I liked the imagery of, like, standing next to a giant expanse of land being like, well, now what?
Yeah.
Dune buggy, I guess.
Yeah. Is there a hill I can roll down?
Yeah, something.
That's fun. And then, it kind of feels like what you were saying about your process at the very beginning, where you were talking about, like, okay, here's our state, right? We've got a giant expanse of land, or I've got this idea for a game, but something doesn't feel like, it doesn't feel energizing, or it feels too big. How can we solve this? And then, like, coming up with some novel way or fun way of changing that state, you know, moving it, bringing in some, you know, conventions from a different genre, or coming up with, like, a dune buggy or something to get your character across the Nebraska keeps coming to mind, so I'm just going to say it. But, like, you can play with that, and that's what it is, I guess, in a nutshell. Play with it and have fun with it. And if you're having fun doing it and people are having fun playing it, then you're doing it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.
We solve game development.
Two solutions that we definitely solved today.
Well, I'm glad I was on the final episode. Let's wrap it up.
Solved in under an hour today.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topic, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and Exhausted Man. Exhausted Man. Not like Florida Man?
No.
Okay.
Something very different.
All right, I'll look it up. We like hearing from you, so please tweet back or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, you can just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.